Penguin Audio presents Grasshopper Jungle by Andrew Smith. Read by Philip Church. Part 1. Ealing. I read somewhere that human beings are genetically predisposed to record history. We believe it will prevent us from doing stupid things in the future. But even though we dutifully archived elaborate records of everything we've ever done, we also managed to keep on doing dumber and dumber shit. This is my history. There are things in here. Babies with two heads. Insects as big as refrigerators. God. The devil. Limbless warriors. Rocket ships. Sex. Diving bells. Theft. Wars. Monsters. Internal combustion engines. Love. Cigarettes. Joy. Bomb shelters. Pizza and cruelty. Just like it's always been. Kimber Drive. Robbie Breeze and I made the road the Ealing Mall is built on. Before we outgrew our devotion to BMX bicycles, the constant back-and-forth ruts we cut through the field we named Grasshopper Jungle became the natural sweep of Kimber Drive, as though the dirt graders and street engineers who paved it couldn't help but follow the tracks Robbie and I had laid. Robbie and I were the gods of concrete rivers, and history does prove to us that wherever boys ride bicycles, paved roadways ribbon along afterward like intestinal tapeworms. So the mall went up, built like a row of happy lower teeth, grinned for a while, and then about a year ago, some of the shops there began shutting down, blackening out like cavities when people left our town for other, better places. BMX riding was for middle school kids. We still had our bikes, and I believe that there were times Robbie and I thought about digging them out of the cobwebbed corners of our family's garages, but now that we were in high school, or at least in high school classes, because we'd attended Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy since kindergarten, we rode skateboards, and also managed to sneak away in Robbie's old car. We were in 10th grade, and Robbie could drive, which was very convenient for me and my girlfriend, Shan Collins. We could always depend on Robbie, and I counted on the hope, the erotic plan I fantasized over, that one night he'd drive us out along the needle-straight roads cutting through the seas of cornfields surrounding Ealing, and Robbie wouldn't say anything at all as I climbed on top of Shan and had sex with her right there on the piles of Robbie's laundry that always seemed to lie scattered and unwashed in the dirty old Ford Explorer his dad left behind. Fixing feet. On the Friday that ended our painfully slow first week after spring break, Robbie and I took our boards and skated through the filthy back alley of Grasshopper Jungle. Nobody cared about skaters anymore. Well, at least nobody cared among the four remaining businesses that managed to stay open in the Ealing Mall after the McKeon plant closed down, the laundromat Robbie never quite made it to, the pancake house, and the liquor and thrift stores owned by Shan's stepdad. So we could skate there, and did pretty much whatever we wanted to do. Judging from the empty beer cans, the mysterious floral sleeper sofa we were certain was infested with pubic lice, and the pungent smell of piss in the alley, it was clear everyone else in Ealing was similarly okay with the no-limits code of conduct in Grasshopper Jungle too. And that proved to be an unfortunate fact for me and Robbie on that Friday. We had built ramps from sagging flaps of plywood that we laid across a flight of concrete steps behind a vacant unit that used to be a foot doctor's office.
Bad business plan, Robbie said.
What?
Fixing people's feet in a town everyone's dying to run away from.
Robbie was so smart it hurt my head to think about how sad he could be sometimes.
We should go into business, I said.
Want to have a fag?
Robbie liked calling cigarettes fags.
Okay.
There was no way we'd ever sit down on that couch. We upended blue plastic milk crates and sat with forearms resting across our knees while we propped our feet on our boards and rocked them back and forth like we floated over invisible and soothing waves. Robbie was a better smoker. He could inhale thick, deep clouds of cigarette smoke and blow life-sized ghost models of both of us when he'd casually lean back and exhale. I liked cigarettes, but I'd never smoke if Robbie didn't.
What kind of business? Robbie said.
I don't know. I could write stuff. Maybe comic books.
And you could draw me.
Robbie took a big drag from his cigarette.
I'd be like your spokesmodel or something.
I have to explain. I have that obsession with history, too. In one corner of my closet, stacked from the floor to the middle of my thigh, sits a pile of notebooks and composition binders filled with all the dumb shit I've ever done. My hope was that one day, my dumb history would serve as the source for countless fictional accounts of, well, shit. And I drew, too.
There were thousands of sketches of me, of Shan and Robbie in those books. I consider it my job to tell the truth. What exactly does a spokesmodel do?
We speak and look good at the same time. It's a tough job, so I'd expect to make decent money.
Multitasking. The shit out of it, Porcupine. Robbie called me Porcupine because of how I wore my hair. I didn't mind. Everyone else called me Austin. Austin Zerba. It is Polish. Sometimes in wonder, I can marvel at the connections that spiderweb through time and place. How a dying bull in Tsarist Russia may have been responsible for the end of the world in Ealing, Iowa.
It is the truth. When he was a young man, Unze Sturba, who was my great-great-great-grandfather, was exiled from his home in a small farming village called Kovala. Unze Sturba had been involved in a radical movement to resist the imposition of Russian language and culture on Poles. Unze, like many Polish boys, hoped that one day his country, which had been treated like a sausage between the dog jaws of selfish neighboring empires, would be able to stand on its own. It was a good idea, but it was not going to happen in Unze's lifetime. So Unze was forced to leave Kovala and travel to Siberia. He did not get very far. The train carrying the exiled Unze derailed when it struck a dying bull that had collapsed on the tracks. It was a terrible accident. Unze was left, presumed dead, abandoned in the middle of a snowy field. Unze Sturba wore a silver medallion with an image of Saint Casimir, who was the patron saint of Poland, on a chain around his neck. He believed Saint Casimir had saved his life in the train wreck, and every day for the rest of his life, Unze would kiss the medal and say a prayer, thanking Saint Casimir. It was a fortunate thing for me that Unze Sturba did not die in that snowy field. Wounded, he walked for 2 days until he came to the town of Hrodna, where he hid from the Russians and ultimately married a Polish girl named Aniela Masolka, who was my great-great-great-grandmother. Unze's healthy Polish semen made 4 Catholic children with Aniela, 2 boys and 2 girls. Only one of them, his youngest son, Kreese, would ever end up near Ealing, Iowa. This is my history. Lewis asks a rhetorical question. We leaned our backs against the cinder block wall, smoking in the cut of shade from a green rolling dumpster. And at just about the same time I talked Robbie into taking his car to drive us over to Shan Collins' new old house, I looked up and noticed the population of Grasshopper Jungle had increased uncomfortably. 4 boys from Herbert Hoover High, the public school, had been watching us while they leaned against the galvanized steel railing along the edge of the stairways we had been using for a ramp.
Candy cane faggots getting ready to make out with each other in Piss Alley.
The candy cane thing. That was what Hoover boys enjoyed calling boys from Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy. Not just because it kind of rhymed. We had to wear ties to school. Whoever invented the uniform could have planned better to avoid the striped red and white design of them. Because when we'd wear our ties, white shirts, and blue sweaters with the little embroidered crosses inside blood red hearts, you couldn't help but think we looked like, well, patriotic Christian boy candy canes. But Robbie and I weren't big enough losers to still be wearing our uniforms while skating. Well, we weren't so much skating as smoking cigarettes, actually. Robbie wore a Hormel Spam t-shirt and baggy jeans with holes in them he sagged so low you could see half his citrus motif boxers. They had oranges and lemons on them. Citrus does not grow in Iowa. I wore yellow and green basketball shorts and a black Orwell's tee. So we didn't look like candy cane boys. The Orwells are a punk band from Illinois. The other part, the faggot part. Well, let's just say Robbie got picked on. A lot. I only knew one of the boys, Grant Wallace. It's hard not to know pretty much every kid in a town the size of Ealing, even if you didn't pay too much attention to people as a rule. However, I did know this. Grant and his friends were there for no other reason than to start crap. It was bound to be historic, too. And 2 140-pound candy cane faggot sophomores with cigarettes and skateboards were not likely to stop anything 4 bored and corn-fed 12th graders from Hoover had in mind. Robbie just sat back casually against the wall, puffing away on his cigarette. I couldn't help but think he looked like a guy in one of those old black-and-white movies about firing squads and blindfolds, and the Foreign Legion and shit like that. One of Grant's friends, a pudgy guy with a face full of whiteheads and only one eyebrow, took his cell phone out from his pocket and began recording video of us. Consult history. Nothing good ever happens when cell phones are used to record video. And I guess that was as good as Grant's directorial cue to begin.
Let me and Tyler borrow you guys' skateboards for a few minutes. We'll bring them back.
Tyler must have been the mule-faced kid on Grant's right, because he nodded all excited, an encouragement for us to be cooperative candy cane faggots. But Robbie said no before the question was entirely out of Grant's mouth. The truth is, and history will back me up on this too, that when kids like Grant ask kids like me and Robbie if they can borrow stuff like skateboards, the boards are either going to get stolen, or the kids like me and Robbie are going to be beaten up, and then the boards are going to get stolen. The way kids like me and Robbie get beaten up first is when one of them says no. History class is over for today. We got beaten up by Grant Wallace, Tyler, and some other kid who smelled like he had barf on his sleeves, while the fourth kid filmed it with his cell phone. Oh, and extra credit in history. You should never wear loose mesh basketball shorts and boxer underwear if you're going to get kneed in the balls. Just so you know for the future. I don't even think either one of us made it all the way to his feet before the kicks and punches started. Robbie got a bloody nose. Grant took our boards and chucked them up onto the roof of the pancake house. Then the four Hoover boys took our shoes off and threw them on the roof too. And if the boards didn't make such a racket when they landed, Grant and his friends would have taken Robbie's and my pants and sent them up to shoe and skateboard heaven too. But the Chinese guy named Lewis, who worked in the kitchen of the pancake house, stuck his face out the back door and asked politely what we thought we were doing. I do not know what I thought I was doing. But that question, in itself, when asked by a Chinese pancake chef named Lewis, was enough to make Grant and his friends call an end to their diversion. I was curled up on my side, cupping my nuts, while the sleeve of my black Orwell's t-shirt adhered to some gooey piss stain on Grasshopper Jungle's asphalt. Grant and the Hoover boys left, and Lewis, apparently satisfied with the lack of an answer to his rhetorical question about what we boys thought we were doing, shut the door. For a moment, I found myself wondering, too, why guys like Grant Wallace, who called guys like me and Robbie Breeze faggots, always seemed to take pleasure in removing the trousers of littler guys. That would be a good question for the books, I thought. There's blood on your spam.
Are you hurt? Balls. Knee. Boxers.
There's blood on your spam.
Shit.
Grant Wallace murdered me. Robbie felt bad, not because of his bloody nose, because he blamed himself when things like this happened. He cried a little, and that made me sad. We recovered. History shows, after things like that, you either get up and have a cigarette, in your socks with your bloody friend, or you don't. Since it wasn't time for Robbie and me to die, we decided to have a smoke. I believe Unze Sturba would have wanted a smoke when he pulled himself, bloodied, up from the wreckage in that snowy field in Poland. There are as many theories on how to deal with a bloody nose as there are ears of corn in all the combined silos of Iowa. Robbie's approach was artistic. Propping himself dog-like on his hands and knees, he hung his head down, depositing thick crimson coins of blood from his nostrils and simultaneously puffing a cigarette while he drip-drip-dripped a pointless message on the blacktop. Grant Wallace murdered me. I watched and smoked and wondered how our shoes and skateboards were getting along up there on the roof. Unfortunately, as funny as it was to both of us, Robbie stopped bleeding after forming the second A, so he only got as far as Grant Wa. Nobody's going to know what that means, I said.
I should have used lowercase.
Lowercase does use less blood, and a smaller font. Everyone knows that.
Maybe you should punch me again.
I realized I'd never punched anyone in my life. I don't think so, Robbie. You got any quarters on you?
Why?
Let's go throw our shirts in the laundry place. You need to learn how to use those things anyway. So Robbie and I limped around to the front of the mall and went inside Ealing Coin Wash Laundrette, where, maximizing the return on our investment, we not only washed our t-shirts, but the socks we had on as well.
This is boring,
Robbie observed while we waited for the fifth dime we slotted into the dryer to magically warm the dampness and detergent from our clothes.
No wonder I never come here.
Doesn't your apartment building have a laundry room?
It's nasty.
Worse than this?
This? This is like Hawaii, Porcupine. Sitting here with you barefoot with no shirts on, watching socks and shit go around?
Robbie lived alone with his mom in a tiny two-bedroom at a place called the Del Vista Arms, a cheap stucco apartment building only 3 blocks from Grasshopper Jungle. We walked there, in our damp laundered socks and t-shirts. Two of the apartments on Robbie's floor had pay-or-quit notices taped to their doors.
Wait here,
he said, and he quietly snuck inside. It meant his mother was home. Robbie usually didn't like people to come over when his mom was there. I knew that. He was just going to get the keys to the Ford and take me for a ride anyway. So I waited. The blood didn't come out of your spam shirt, I said. We drove west, down Mercantile Street toward my house, and I noticed the diffused brown splotches of post-laundered blood that dotted Robbie's chest. And he was still in his socks, too. I'll loan you a pair of shoes when we get to my house, I offered. Then let's go get Shan and do something. I glanced over my shoulder and checked out the back seat. I wondered if I would ever not be horny, or confused about my horniness, or confused about why I got horny at stuff I wasn't supposed to get horny at. As history is my judge, probably not.
I think we should go up on the roof and get our shit back, tonight when no one will see us. Those were my best shoes.
Actually, those were Robbie's only non-Lutheran boy school shoes. I was willing. I bet there's some cool shit up on that roof, I said.
Oh, yeah. No doubt everyone in Ealing hides their cool shit up on the roof of the pancake house.
Or maybe not. What made this country great? Robbie had an older sister named Sheila. Sheila was married and lived with her husband and Robbie's 6-year-old nephew in Cedar Falls. I had a brother named Eric. Eric was in Afghanistan, shooting at people and shit like that. As bad as Cedar Falls is, even the Del Vista Arms for that matter, Eric could have gone somewhere better than Afghanistan. Both our moms took little blue pills to make them feel not so anxious. My mom took them because of Eric, and Robbie's mom needed pills because when we were in 7th grade, Robbie's dad left and didn't come back. My dad was a history teacher at Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy, and my mom was a bookkeeper at the Hy-Vee, so we had a house and a dog and shit like that. Hy-Vee sells groceries and shit. My parents were predictable and ominous. They also weren't home yet when Robbie and I got there in our still wet socks and t-shirts.
Watch out for dog shit,
I said as we walked across the yard.
Austin, you should mow your lawn.
Then it would make the dog shit too easy to see, and my dad would tell me to pick it up. So I'd have to mow the lawn and pick up dog shit.
It's thinking like that that made this country great, Robbie said. You know, if they ever gave a Nobel Prize for avoiding work, every year some white guy in Iowa would get $1 million and a trip to Sweden.
Thinking about me and Robbie going to Sweden made me horny. Shan's new old house. First thing, naturally, we got food from the kitchen. We also made dirt tracks on the floor because socks are notoriously effective when it comes to redistributing filth from sidewalks, lawns, the Del Vista Arms, and Robbie's untidy old Ford Explorer. I boiled water, and we took cups of noodles and Doritos into my room. Robbie sat on my bed and ate, waiting patiently while I recorded the last little bit of the day's history in my notebook.
Here,
I tossed my cell phone over to the bed. Call Shan.
Have you ever smelled a Dorito?
I had to think about it. I wrote, probably not.
Just checking,
he said.
'Cause they smell like my nephew's feet.
Why did you smell a 6-year-old kid's feet?
Good question.
As usual, Shan got mad because I had Robbie call her using my phone. And when she answered, she thought it was me. This, quite naturally, made me horny. But Robbie explained to her I was writing, and he told her that something terrible had happened to us. He asked if it would be okay that we came over to her new old house as soon as we finished eating. Robbie was such a suave communicator when it came to relaying messages to Shan. In fact, I believed it was the biggest component of why she was so much in love with me. Sometimes, I wished I could cut off Robbie's head and attach it to my body. But there were more than a couple things wrong with that idea. First, uncomfortably enough, it kind of made me horny to think about a hybridized Robbie Austin having sex with Shan. And second, decapitation was a sensitive topic in Ealing. Well, anywhere, really. But in Ealing during the late 1960s, there was this weird string of serial murders that went unsolved. And they all involved headlessness. History is full of decapitations, and Iowa is no exception. So, after we finished eating, I outfitted Robbie with some clean socks, a Titus Andronicus t-shirt, I changed into an Animal Collective shirt, all my tees are bands, and gave him my nicest pair of Adidas. And both of us tried to pretend we didn't notice my dad's truck pulling up the drive just as we took off for Shan's. Perfect timing, I said. Robbie answered by pushing in the dashboard cigarette lighter. Besides all the head-cutting-off shit that went on 50 years ago,
Ealing was also known for Dr. Grady McKeon, founder of McKeon Industries, which up until about 6 months ago, employed over half the town's labor force. Grady McKeon was some kind of scientist, and he made a fortune from defense programs during the Cold War. When the fight against communism went south on McKeon, the factory retooled and started manufacturing sonic pulse showerheads and toothbrushes, which ultimately became far more profitable when made in Malaysia or somewhere like that. So the factory shut down, and that's also why most of the Ealing Strip Mall was deserted, and why every time I visited Robbie at the Del Vista Arms, there were more and more pay-or-quit notices hanging on doors. And that's half a century of an Iowa town's history in four sentences. Grady McKeon was gone, but his much younger brother still lived and ran businesses in Ealing. Johnny McKeon owned Tipsy Cricket Liquors and the From Attic to Cellar thrift store, both of which were big crowd pleasers at the strip mall. Johnny, who was responsible for thinking up the names of those two establishments entirely on his own, was also Shan's stepfather. And Shannon Collins, whom Robbie and I called Shan, her mother, the relatively brand new Mrs. McKeon, and Johnny had just taken ownership of the McKeon house, a decrepit old wooden monstrosity that was on the registry of historic homes in Ealing. Well, actually, it was the only historic home in Ealing. It took Robbie and me 2 cigarettes to get to Shan's new old house. It had already been a rough day. We were going to need another pack. Going somewhere you shouldn't go. Shannon kissed me on the lips at the door of her new old house. She kissed Robbie on the lips, too. Shan always kissed Robbie on the mouth after she kissed me. It made me horny. I wondered what she would say if I asked her to have a threesome with us in her new old unfurnished bedroom. I knew what Robbie would say. Duh. I wondered if it made me homosexual to even think about having a threesome with Robbie and Shan. And I hated knowing that it would be easier for me to ask Robbie to do it than to ask my own girlfriend. I felt myself turning red and starting to sweat uncomfortably in my Animal Collective shirt. And I realized that for a good 3.5 minutes, I stood there at the doorway to a big empty house that smelled like old people's skin, thinking about three ways involving my friends. So I wondered if that meant I was gay. I hadn't been listening to anything Shan and Robbie were talking about, and while I was pondering my sexuality, they were probably thinking about how I was an idiot. I might just as well have been a blow-up doll. These are things I don't write down in the history books, but probably should. I don't think any historians ever wrote shit like that.
You have to excuse him. He got kneed in the balls. Huh?
Robbie nudged me with his shoulder and said it again, louder, because idiots always understand English when you yell it at them.
You have to excuse him. He got kneed in the balls.
Shan put her hand flat on the side of my face, the way that real moms, who don't take lots of drugs every day, do to little boys they'd think might be sick. Real moms have sensors or some kind of shit like that in their hands. Shan's mom, Mrs. McKeon, was a real mom. She also used to be a nurse before she married Johnny McKeon.
Are you okay, Austin?
Huh? Yeah, oh, I'm sorry, Shan. I was kind of tripping out about something. Having a three-way in Sweden with Robbie and her was what I was tripping out about. But I didn't tell her. Shan's room was empty. The entire house was mostly empty. So our footsteps and voices echoed like sound effects in horror films about three kids who are going somewhere they shouldn't go. Thinking about things like that definitely did not make me horny. In fact, just about the only things I noticed in that musty mausoleum of a house were unopened boxes, brand new ones, containing McKeon pulsomatic showerheads and toothbrushes.
The moving van's going to be here this afternoon. They just finished at the house,
Shan explained as the three of us stood awkwardly in her empty, echoey room. Because, in an empty bedroom with creaky old wood floors, it is a natural human response to just stand there and shift your weight from foot to foot and think about sex. Robbie's volcano. Shan and I started going out with each other in 7th grade. When I think about it, a lot of stuff happened to us that year. There are 9 filled, double-sided paged volumes of Austin Serba's unexpurgated history of Ealing, Iowa for that year alone. That year, Eric went into the Marines and left me at home, brotherless, with our dog named Ingrid, a rusty golden retriever with a real dynamo of an excretory tract. People in Ealing use expressions like real dynamo whenever something moves faster than a growing stalk of corn. It was also the same year Robbie's dad went to Guatemala to film a documentary about volcanic eruption. Lots of stuff erupted that year, because Mr. Breeze met a woman, got her pregnant, and expatriated to Guatemala.
And, just like a lot of boys in seventh grade, I started erupting quite frequently then, too. A real dynamo. And, that year, Shannon Collins' mom moved to Ealing, enrolled her daughter at Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy, where we were all good, non-smoking, non-erupting Christians, and married Johnny McKeon, the owner of From Attic to Cellar Consignment Store and Tipsy Cricket Liquors. And I fell in love with Shan Collins. It was a very confusing time. I didn't realize then, in seventh grade as I was, that the time, and the eruptions, and everything else that happened to me would only keep getting more and more confusing through grades 8, 9, and 10. I will tell you how it was I managed to get Shan Collins to fall in love with me, too. My best friend, Robbie Breeze, taught me how to dance. I was infatuated with Shan from the moment I saw her. But, being the new kid at school, and new in Ealing, Shan kept pretty much to herself, especially when it came to such things as eruptive, real dynamo, horny 13-year-old boys. Robbie noticed how deeply smitten I was by Shan, so he selflessly taught me how to dance, just in time for the Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy end-of-year mixed gender mixer. Normally, genders were not something that were permitted to mix at Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy. So I went over to Robbie's apartment every night for 2.5 weeks, and we played vinyl records in his room and he taught me how to dance. This was just after Robbie and his mother had to move out of their house and into the Del Vista Arms. Robbie was always the best dancer of any guy I ever knew, and girls like Shan love boys who can dance. History does show that boys who dance are far more likely to pass along their genes than boys who don't. Boys who dance are genetic volcanoes. It made me feel confused, though, dancing alone with Robbie in his bedroom, because it was kind of, well, fun and exceptional, in the same way that smoking cigarettes made me feel horny. Seventh grade was also when Robbie and I stole a pack of cigarettes from Robbie's mom. By the time we got into 10th grade, Robbie's mom started buying them for us. She might take drugs and not have one of those sensor things in the palm of her hand like real moms do, but Mrs. Breeze doesn't mind when teenage boys smoke cigarettes in her house and dance with each other, alone in the bedroom. And that's saying something. That year, at the end of 7th grade, Robbie confessed that he'd rather dance with me than with any girl. He didn't just mean dance. It was very confusing to me. It made me wonder more about myself, whom I doubted, than about Robbie, whom I suppose I love. At first, I thought Robbie would grow out of it. You know, start erupting like everyone else. But there was nothing wrong with Robbie's volcano, and he never did grow out of it. So it was at the Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy end-of-year mixed gender mixer that Robbie casually and bravely walked up to the new girl, Shan Collins, and announced to her,
"My friend Austin Zerba is shy. That's him over there. He's good-looking, don't you think? He's also a nice guy. He writes poetry. He's a really fantastic dancer. He would like very much if you would agree to dance with him."
And everything, confusing as it was, worked out beautifully for me and Shan and Robbie after that. Doors that go somewhere. Doors that go nowhere.
"Okay, so basically this house is like infested with demons or something," Shan told us.
Demonic infestations have a way of making guys feel not so horny. "It's in the Ealing Registry of Historical Homes," I pointed out.
"People died here. You should get that kind of air freshener shit that you plug into outlets so it masks the scent of death and decay with springtime potpourri,"
Robbie offered.
"Look at this," she said. "There are doors that go nowhere, and I swear I heard something ticking and rattling inside my wall a moment ago."
Shan used words like moment. She wasn't from Ealing. One of the walls in her creaky room had two doors set into it. The wall itself was kind of creepy. It had wallpaper with flowers that seemed to float like stemless clones between wide red stripes. If I pictured a room where I was going to murder someone, aside from the instruments of torture and shit like that, it would have this wallpaper. If I was on death row, awaiting electrocution, I'd be wearing pajamas with the same pattern on them. Shan went to the door on the left and pulled it open. When she opened it, there was only the jamb and frame of the door, and then a wall of bricks behind it.
"See?"
I could only imagine what was on the other side of the bricks. Robbie, naturally, felt compelled to say something less than comforting.
"I suggest you don't liberate whatever's imprisoned back there," he said.
Shan was getting angry. I knew I should intervene, but I didn't know what to say. "Nowadays, people spend a lot of money for distressed bricks like those," I said. It was probably for the best that Shan wasn't paying attention to me.
"And look at this.
she said. When she opened the second door, a long narrow stairway extended down into darkness on the other side. The chasm was at least 20 feet deep, but it dead-ended at another distressed brick wall, and there were no other doorways leading off in any direction that I could see. What can you expect from a house this old? I asked. It was a good question. Ghosts and shit like that was what I was thinking, though. You wouldn't expect miniature ponies and trained talking peacocks that dispensed sugar babies and gumballs from their asses, would you?
I don't want to stay in this room by myself, Shan said.
And that made me very horny again. I also wanted candy. Shan, obviously stressed, looked at Robbie, then at me.
I need to talk to you, Austin, she said,
and motioned for me to go with her down the candyless staircase of death and decay. Robbie took the hint.
I need to go to the bathroom, maybe pulsomatic my teeth, or take a shower, or something.
He made a tentative weight-shifting creak onto one leg, and I followed Shan behind door number two. We sat beside each other on the staircase. Our bare legs touched. Shan had a perfect body, a Friday-after-school body that was mostly visible because she was barefoot and wore tight, cuffed shorts with a cantaloupe-colored halter top. A boy could go insane, I thought, just being this close to Shan's uncovered shoulders, wheat hair, and heavy breasts. This staircase to nothing was a fitting dungeon for constantly erupting, real dynamo 16-year-old boys like me.
Why is Robbie wearing your clothes? And what happened to you and him?
While we sat there, three important things struck me about Shan. First, I realized that, like most girls I knew, Shan could ask questions in machine gun bursts that peppered the male brain with entirely unrelated projectiles of interrogation. Second, it was often unstated, but clear by her tone that Shan was jealous of Robbie, possibly to the point of being a little curious about my sexuality. I know, maybe that was also my confusion as well. Because third, what was most troubling to me, was that despite all the fantasies, all the intricately structured if-then scenarios I concocted involving Shan Collins and me, whenever an opportunity to take action presented itself, like being alone with her in a nearly sealed dungeon, I became timid and restrained. I couldn't understand it at all. History chews up sexually uncertain boys, and spits us out as recycled generic greeting cards for lonely old men. Dr. Grady McKeon was a lonely old man. I can only conclude he must have also, at one time, been a sexually confused, unexplainably horny teenage boy who erupted all over everything at the least opportune times. He was 25 years old, and well on his way to building an empire of profits when his younger brother, Johnny, was born. I once heard a tobacco-chewing hog farmer say that, in Iowa, folks liked to spread out their children like dog shit on a dance floor. Dr. Grady McKeon would be Shan's step-uncle, if there is such a thing, and if he weren't dead. He was the last person to live in the historic McKeon house. He died when his private jet went down in the Gulf of Mexico. Its engines choked to death on ash from Mount Huacamoctli, the same erupting volcano in Guatemala that Robert Brees Sr. was filming a documentary on. And it also happened the same year Robbie Brees and I smoked our first cigarette, danced together, and I fell in love with Shannon Collins. Johnny McKeon never wanted to live in his dead brother's old house. It took Shan's mother about 4 years of badgering to get him to finally break down and take the place out of mothballs. I held Shan's hand, and we sat there in the dungeon with our legs pressed together, and I was so frustrated I felt like I could explode. But I concentrated, and methodically went through the entire account of what happened to me and Robbie at Grasshopper Jungle. I told her about our plan to climb up onto the roof of the Ealing Mall to get our stuff back.
I'm coming with you, she decided.
Not up on the roof, I said, so authoritatively my voice lowered an octave. Sounding fatherlike to Shan in the echoing darkness of the staircase that led to nowhere made me feel horny, demons or not. I scooted closer and put my arm around her, so that my fingers relaxed and splayed across the little swath of exposed skin above the waist of her shorts.
I'll wait in Robbie's car. I'll be your lookout.
Shan, I said. I almost had myself convinced to ask her if she didn't think it was time we had sex, and the thought made me feel dizzy. I would force myself to no longer have any doubt or confusion, to not wind up recycled by history.
What?
This staircase really is creepy. And just as I pushed her firmly against the distressed brick wall and put my open mouth over hers, Robbie swung the door wide above us and said,
"The moving van's here."
Curfew.
While Shan's mom, the movers, and Johnny McKeon worked at unloading and organizing the house full of furniture they'd shipped over from their old but much newer house, the three of us stole away in Robbie's Ford Explorer on our mission to reclaim our shoes and skateboards. Friday nights in Ealing, Iowa rarely got more thrilling than climbing up on the roof of a three-quarters abandoned mall, and we were up for the excitement. On Fridays, my curfew came at midnight, which meant that if I was quiet enough, I could stay out until just before my mother served breakfast on Saturday morning. I had to check in with my dad and mom, so they'd know I was still alive. I told them I was going out for pizza with Robbie and Shan. It wasn't a lie. It was an abbreviation. I was not concerned about going to hell. Nobody who was born and raised in Ealing, Iowa was afraid of hell, or Afghanistan, or living at the Del Vista Arms. Checking in for Robbie meant swinging by his two-bedroom deluxe apartment at the Del Vista Arms and asking his mom for $5 and a fresh pack of cigarettes, while Shan and I waited in the parking lot. Shan did not smoke. She was smarter than Robbie and me, but she didn't complain about our habit. Stupid people should never read books. It took me a very long time to work up the nerve to kiss Shan Collins, who was the first and only girl I had ever kissed. There was a possibility that I'd never have kissed her too, because she was the one who actually initiated the kiss. It happened nearly one full year after the Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy end-of-year mixed-gender mixer. Like Robbie explained to her, I was shy. I was on the conveyor belt toward the paper shredder of history with countless scores of other sexually confused boys. After the Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy end-of-year mixed-gender mixer, I tried to get Shan to pay more serious attention to me. I tried any reasonable method I could think of. I joined the archery club when I found out she was a member, and I offered multiple times to do homework with her. Sadly, nothing seemed to result in serious progress. At last, all I could do was let Shan Collins know that I would be there for her if she ever needed a friend or a favor. I do not believe I had any ulterior motives in telling her such a thing. Well, to be honest, I probably did. I'd leave notes for Shan tucked inside her school books. I would compliment her on her outfit. She laughed at such things. Shan knew it was a ridiculous thing to write, since all the girls at Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy dressed exactly the same way. Still, history will show that patient boys with a sense of humor, who can also dance, tend to have more opportunities to participate in the evolution of the species than boys who give up and mope quietly on the sidelines. But I began to worry. Rumors were spreading around Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy about me and Robbie, even though I never heard anything directly. Then, in the second semester of eighth grade, I was called into the headmaster's office for something I wrote in a book report. Even though the book I read was in Curtis Crane's library, as well as the Ealing Public Library, apparently nobody other than kids had bothered to read the book until I wrote my report on it. The book was called The Chocolate War, and the copy I read belonged to my brother, Eric. Mrs. Edith Mitchell, who was the 8th grade English teacher, assumed the book was about a candy kingdom or something. She probably thought there were magical talking peacocks in the book that shot gumballs and sugar babies out of their asses. But there were teenage boys in the book, Catholic boys, who masturbated. Boys who attend Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy are not allowed to masturbate. My father nearly lost his job because I wrote a report on a book that had Catholic boys and masturbation in it. Pastor Roland Duff, the headmaster at Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy, was very distraught. He had the school's only copy of The Chocolate War resting on his desk when I came to his office. There, he counseled me about masturbation and Catholicism.
"My fear is that when boys read books such as this," he said, "they will assume there is nothing at all wrong with masturbation and may, out of curiosity, attempt to masturbate. In fact, Austin, it is true that masturbation has serious harmful effects. It makes boys spiritually and physically weak."
The headmaster patted his forehead, which was damp, with a handkerchief that had the Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy logo, a black cross surrounded by a blood-red heart, embroidered on its corner. I wondered if they had prepared him in his religious training for giving teenage boys talks about masturbating. He went on.
"In history, entire armies have been defeated because their soldiers masturbated too frequently. It happened to the Italians in Ethiopia."
When he said the words "too frequently," I wondered if there was some number higher than once or twice per day that would get me off the hook to hell and military failure. In any event, I hoped he was right. I hoped the bad guys in Afghanistan, where my brother Eric, whose book got me into trouble, was fighting, were also excessive masturbators like the Italians. Pastor Roland Duff continued,
"Masturbation can also turn boys into homosexuals,
When he said homosexuals, he waved his hands emphatically like he was shaping a big blob of dough into a homosexual so I could see what he was talking about. That frightened me and made me feel ashamed and confused. Then he called my mother into the office, and he talked to her about masturbation too. Up until that day, I was certain my mother didn't know there was such a thing as masturbation. As I stood there, shifting my weight awkwardly from one foot to the other, Pastor Roland Duff told my mother about the warning signs of masturbation, so she could keep a better watch over me. Then he sent me home with my mother and suspended me from classes for one day. When I came back to school, Mrs. Edith Mitchell made all the girls leave the classroom while Pastor Roland Duff explained the guidelines for books we boys were not allowed to read at Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy. We were no longer permitted to read any books that had masturbation, Catholics, or penises in them. Pastor Roland Duff gave the entire class of boys the same speech he'd given me about masturbation, weakness, and homosexuality. Once again, he blamed masturbation for Italy losing wars. That kind of shit never made it into history books either. Sometimes, during his speech, he would remark,
"As I was explaining to Austin Zerba,"
and he would wave his hands as though he were shaping a doughy Austin Zerba in the air, so all the other boys could see what a boy who wrote a book report about masturbation and Catholics looked like. Then he led the boys in prayer and excused us so Mrs. Edith Mitchell could have a similar talk with the girls. Robbie and I whispered outside that after all that masturbation talk, a cigarette would be nice. It was the worst day of my life since Eric left home. Everyone knew that I was the one to blame for all the trouble about masturbating. At Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy, you couldn't hear the name Austin Zerba and not think about masturbating. I didn't speak in class again for the rest of the year. Robbie thought it was funny and told me I was brave. Best friends do that kind of stuff. When the boys were taken out of the room, I wondered if Mrs. Edith Mitchell was telling the girls about Austin Zerba and how teenage boys masturbate, or if maybe she had found a book with girls who masturbated in it. Thinking about a book like that made me very horny. The library was quieter and emptier than usual for a long time after that day. But when the boys came back into the classroom, Shan deftly slipped a note onto my lap beneath our desks. I thought she was going to tease me about masturbating, but the note said this. "Okay, I'll admit it, Austin Zerba. You have finally won me over. I read The Chocolate War too. I love that book. This school is full of shit. Let's go get a Coke after class and hang out. By the way, I like what you're wearing today." I was dressed exactly like every other boy at Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy. Later that day, Shan Collins and I kissed for the first time. It happened right after I said to her, "Stupid people should never read books." The Death Ray Gun. At 1 hour before midnight, Shan and I waited inside an old Ford Explorer parked behind the Del Vista Arms. Robbie Breeze, dressed in a pair of my clean white socks, best Adidas skate shoes, and Titus Andronicus t-shirt, dashed into his apartment to get us more cigarettes and wave in passing at his mother. Events that night were going to set in motion a disaster that would probably wipe out human life on the planet. That night, I was going to say something to Shan I had never said to anyone. I was going to do something I'd never done, and see things I could not understand and never believe existed. This is history, and it is also the truth. I sat in the front seat. Robbie refused to chauffeur us around like he was some kind of limo driver, he said, so either Shan or I always had to sit up front with him. This rule increased the degree of difficulty in actually fulfilling my fantasy regarding Shan Collins and Robbie's back seat. But now, Robbie was gone.
"What are you doing?"
Shan said as I shimmied my way between the front seats, over the center console where there was still an assortment of cassette tapes that had belonged to Robbie's dad. I thought what I was doing was obvious enough, so I said, "I'm looking for my death ray gun."
"Well, if your ray gun doesn't look like a pair of Robbie's underwear or socks, it isn't back here."
Robbie needed to stop accumulating so much laundry this way, but it did keep the floor of his room tidy. My foot got stuck between the passenger seat and console. My shoe came off. I left it there. "I'm coming back there with you till Robbie comes out."
"Robbie came out in the 7th grade,
Shan said. "A lot of things happened in 7th grade. "There," I said. "I've never been back here alone with you, Shan. It's rather sexy." I thought using the word rather would make me seem mature and like I was not from Ealing.
"I've never heard you say anything like that before, Austin,"
she said. "Rather?"
"No, sexy," Shan explained.
And she was right about that. I never had spoken about sex with Shan. I was too afraid to. Well, it is sexy, I said. I kicked off my other shoe and scooted myself against her. I put my arms around Shan. I leaned into her and brought my feet up onto the bench seat. I put my lips on her neck and licked her. She gasped. Shan, I want to tell you that I'm in love with you. I love you, Shan. I had never said that before either.
Oh, Austin, I love you.
It was the first time Shan said it, too. Then the dome light in the Explorer blinked on. Robbie opened the driver's door.
You are not having sex in my car, on top of my clothes, Robbie said.
I don't remember exactly how it happened, but the basketball shorts I'd been wearing that day were halfway down to my knees.
No. Robbie, no.
Shan coughed nervously and straightened up while I pulled my shorts back over my hips.
One of you, Robbie said sternly, up front, now. Let's go get our shit.
I squeezed my way back into the front seat. Robbie gave me an intense, scolding stare. He shook his head and laughed at me. Robbie wasn't angry. Robbie was as shocked as I was. He and I both knew what probably would have happened if he had waited about one more minute before coming back to the car. I extracted my shoe from the center console. Somehow my socks had come off, too. I tried to find them. Clothing has a way of abandoning ship sometimes. Then Robbie dropped a pack of cigarettes in my lap and pushed in the dashboard lighter. He started the car.
Light one for me, Porcupine, he said.
Robbie could have been a preacher. We cased the Ealing Mall. We sat across the street at Stan's Pizza, where we ate and watched through the window. Stan's closed at midnight. Stan was visibly angry that we came in and ordered. There was nobody in the place, and Stan wanted to go home. I ordered a large Stan Prime in an attempt to cheer Stan up. We'll have a large Stan Prime, please, for here, I said. In the same way that Johnny McKeon was proud for coming up with the names Tipsy Cricket Liquors and From Attic to Cellar Consignment Store entirely on his own, and just as Dr. Grady McKeon was considered a genius for inventing the brand Pulse-O-Matic, Stan must have been very pleased with himself for creating the concept of the Stan Prime. People from Ealing were very creative. We didn't know for certain that Stan's real name was Stan. We never asked him. Stan was Mexican, so probably not. We sat, ate, and watched. Stan watched us. Everything was dark at the Ealing Mall across the street, except the sign over the Ealing Coin Wash Laundrette. The laundrette never closed. There was no need to. Between the hours of 2 and 6 a.m., there was more of a public bathroom, a hash den, or a place to have sex than a laundrette, though. Thinking about having sex on the floor of the Ealing Coin Wash Laundrette suddenly made me horny. Nobody was out there. This was Ealing at nighttime. Nobody ever had any reason to be out, unless they were standing on the curb watching their house burn down. I wondered if Ollie Jungfrau had gone home. Ollie worked at Johnny McKeon's liquor store. Tipsy Cricket closed at midnight, too, but it was already completely dark by the time Stan scooted the tin pizza disc containing his eponymous creation down on our table by the window. This was the first time in history anyone from Ealing, Iowa used the word eponymous. You could get beaten up in Ealing for using words like that. Just like Robbie and I got beaten up for sitting there smoking cigarettes and being queers. But I don't know if I'm really queer. Just some people think so. We ate. Robbie asked Stan for 3 ice waters, please. Stan was not a happy man. We couldn't finish the Stan Prime. It was too big. Stan brought us a box for the 3 slices we had left on his tin disc.
Do you think we should make a plan or something? I asked.
Robbie said,
This is Ealing. There's some kind of prohibition against making plans.
If we didn't hate being Lutherans so much, Robbie could easily have been a preacher.
Never name a pizza joint Stan's. Robbie parked the Explorer at the end of Grasshopper Jungle. He positioned the vehicle facing Kimber Drive so we could make a quick getaway if we had to, like real dynamos. The pretense of doing something daring and wrong made the rescue of our shoes and skateboards a more thrilling mission to us. Nobody, ultimately, would give a shit about 2 teenage boys who'd been embarrassed and beaten up by some assholes from Hoover who climbed up on an insignificant strip mall to get their shoes back. Shan waited in the back seat. When we were about 10 feet from the car, Robbie got an idea.
Wait, he said. We should leave our shoes in the Explorer.
It made sense, like most of the shit Robbie told me. Once we got up on the roof, it would be easier if we didn't have to carry so much stuff back down. we could wear our roof shoes to make our descent. It was really good that Grant Wallace and those dipshits didn't throw our pants up there too, I thought. We went back to the car. Shan was already asleep on top of Robbie's underwear and shit. We took off our shoes and left them on the front seat. Robbie grabbed his pack of cigarettes and a book of matches and said,
"Now we can do this."
A narrow steel ladder hung about 6 feet down from the roof's edge. It was impossible to reach the bottom of it, so Robbie and I rolled the heavy green dumpster across the alley and lined it up below the ladder. Then we climbed on top of the dumpster in our socks. I didn't believe the garbage collectors ever emptied the thing anymore. The dumpster was sticky and leaked a trail of dribbling fluid that smelled like piss and vomit when we rolled it away from the cinder block wall beside the pubic lice-infested couch. From the top of the dumpster, we could barely reach the lowest rung on the ladder. I gave Robbie a boost. His socks, which were actually my socks, felt wet and gooey in the stirrup of my palms. I felt especially virile doing a pull-up to get myself onto the ladder after him. Soon, we were up on the roof, where we could stand and look down at the dismal, cancerous sprawl of Ealing. We lit cigarettes. Robbie said,
"You should never name a pizza joint Stan's."
We stood, looking directly across Kimber Drive at the yellowed plastic lens that fronted the long fluorescent tubes illuminating the lettered sign for Stan's Pizza. Someone had painted an A between the S and T, so the sign read Satan's Pizza. People were always doing that to Stan. They did it so many times that Stan simply gave up on cleaning the paint and allowed the sign to say what the good people of Ealing wanted it to say, Satan's Pizza. People from Ealing had a good sense of humor, too. "I have seen Pastor Roland Duff eating there," I said.
"Did he order a Satan preen?"
It was difficult to find our shoes and skateboards up on the roof at night. As I had originally theorized, there was plenty of cool shit up there, so Robbie and I kept getting distracted. It didn't matter much, since Shan had fallen asleep anyway. We found a plastic flamingo with a long metal spike descending from its ass, so you could stick it in your lawn and fool passersby into thinking that flamingos were indigenous to Iowa. Robbie discovered 2 bottles of screw-top wine, full and sealed, and he placed them on the roof beside the top of the ladder. We theorized that maybe back in the days when Ollie was thinner, he may have climbed up here to get drunk and talk to the flamingo. Ollie Jungfrau weighed more than 400 pounds now. Satan's delivered to Tipsy Cricket Liquors.
"Have you ever been drunk, Porcupine?" Robbie said.
"No."
"One of these days, let's get drunk together."
"Okay," I said. Like considering most things that were against some well-intended list of rules, thinking about getting drunk for the first time with Robbie made me feel horny. We found 2 round aluminum canisters that had reels of 16mm film in them. Nobody watched 16mm movies anymore. There was an old projector at Curtis Crane Lutheran Academy, but we decided not to take the films, just in case they were pornos or something. We did want to take the flamingo, though. Robbie placed the plastic pink flamingo next to the bottles of wine.
"One of us can climb down first, then the other can toss down the bird and the wine," Robbie said.
Robbie also found a Halloween mask. It was covered in fur and looked like the face of a grimacing lemur. It was the face a lemur in an electric chair would make. That had to come home with us too, we decided.
"If you ever want to get shot in Ealing, walk through someone's backyard at night with a lemur mask on," Robbie said.
If you ever want to get shot in Ealing. We finally found our shoes and put them on. I was embarrassed to admit it, but it was kind of emotional for us being reunited with our stuff after that very long day. I could see how Robbie felt the same. We put our skateboards down with the rest of the things we'd gathered, and then we sat beside the rooftop air ventilation unit to relax and have another cigarette.
"It feels good to have my shoes back," Robbie said.
"If we didn't find them, I was going to let you have those Adidas of mine."
"Thanks."
We both exhaled smoke at the same time.
"Austin?"
"What?"
"Do you realize that today we got beaten up for being queers?"
"I know."
"But you're not a queer,"
Robbie offered.
"I don't think so." "Well, I apologize."
"You didn't do anything, Rob." Sometimes I called him Rob.
"I've never done anything," he said. "I've never even been kissed or anything, but I still get beaten up."
"Shan kisses you all the time."
"That isn't what I mean."
"I know."
"Well, if I'm going to get beat up for being queer, at least I'd like to know one time what it feels like to be kissed."
I guess you deserve that. You know, everyone deserves to not feel alone.
"Can I kiss you, Austin?"
The air suddenly became unbreathably thin. I thought about it. I shook my head. "That would be too weird.
Sorry.
Don't be. We sat there smoking. Everything was shitty and confusing. Robbie felt terrible. I said,
I guess I would kiss you, Robbie. Don't feel like you have to.
I don't feel that way. So Robbie Breeze, my best friend, and the guy who taught me how to dance so I could set into motion Shan Collins' Falling in Love with Me, scooted around with his shoulders turned toward mine. He was nervous. I was terrified. I watched him swallow a couple times. Then Robbie placed his cigarette carefully down on the gravel beside his foot. He put his hand behind my neck and kissed me. He kissed me the way I kissed Shan, but it felt different, intense, scary. Robbie's tongue tasted like cigarettes when he slid it inside my mouth. I liked the taste, but it made me more confused. Our teeth bumped together. It made a sound like chimes in my head. I never bumped teeth with Shan when I kissed her. When we finished kissing, Robbie pulled his face away and I watched him lick his lips and swallow. Robbie's eyes were wet, like he was going to cry or something. He looked away and wiped his eyes. Robbie said,
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I said you could. I said let's do it.
Is it okay?
I said so, Robbie. It was weird. Really, are you okay?
I think that was the best moment of time in my entire life, Austin.
Robbie wiped his eyes and said,
Thank you. I wanted to ask you to do that forever.
You could have asked me.
I didn't want you to hate me.
How could I hate you?
For wanting to do that to you.
Oh, well, I am sorry if it was clumsy. I didn't know if I was supposed to act like the man or the woman. Robbie picked up his cigarette.
You weren't supposed to act at all.
Good. Because I'm pretty sure I was just being, porcupine. Robbie puffed. You know what, Robbie?
What?
If you ever want to get shot in Ealing, do that in someone's yard at night. The trap door. We sat there without saying anything else until we'd smoked our cigarettes down. I tried not to think about what Robbie and I did. What Robbie and I just did was the only thing I could think about. If I was confused and torn before going up on the roof with Robbie, I was pulp, ready to be spit out by history after we spent a few minutes there. I tried to think like we didn't actually do it, but I could still taste Robbie's mouth and mine. I tried to listen for Shan moving around below us in Grasshopper Jungle, so I wouldn't hear my mind telling me how it would be all right if Robbie asked me if he could kiss me again sometime. It would be thrilling and daring. After midnight, Ealing is quieter than a stone coffin. Robbie could tell I was confused. Tripping out, we would say.
Are you mad at me?
He said.
Shit, I'm not mad. Okay, look.
I hadn't been looking at Robbie. Until he'd said that, I didn't even notice that I was staring at my shoelaces, tracing the zigzag path of them, up, down, back, forth with the tip of my finger, like a train on a white switchback track, from one shoe to the other, over and over. Around the loop, crossover, back and forth. I raised my eyes. Robbie scooted through the gravel away from me. He had lifted a square metal door in the roof, propped it open. I hadn't even realized it was there.
Roof access ladder, Robbie said. It goes down into the secondhand store.
It was left unlocked, I said.
Nobody ever comes up here.
Up here has a watch flamingo and a lemur head.
No one wants to mess with shit like that.
Robbie lowered his face down below the rim of the trap door. He said,
Do you want to go down there?
I had already done something with Robbie I never believed I would do. Climbing down inside Johnny McKeon's secondhand store in the middle of the night was meaningless shit in comparison. I said, That would be cool. When I stood up, I was dizzy. I was like the tip of my finger, zigging and zagging from eye to eye, following a string, making history. Robbie watched me get up. I caught his eyes looking at me. I knew we'd never look at each other the same, and I didn't know how I felt about that. I caught him trying to see if I had an erection. I tried to pull my t-shirt down to cover it. The basketball shorts and boxers I'd been wearing that day revealed yet another strategic flaw for the history books. History shows that erections happen at the worst possible times, and they stick around until someone else notices them. Often, it is either a librarian or an English teacher, like Mrs. Edith Mitchell. I went to the edge of the roof, to the top of the small ladder we'd used to get up there. Shan, I said, I just want to make sure she's okay. Robbie didn't answer. Words like okay can mean all kinds of things. Robbie knew enough that saying anything might nail down a definition of okay that wasn't what either one of us wanted to hear. The Explorer was dark and quiet. Shan was still asleep. We hadn't been gone for more than 20 minutes, even if time seemed to slow to a crawl now. Across the street, Satan's Pizza winked. The fluorescent tubes inside the sign made an audible hiss like a dying wasp when it went dark. Robbie climbed down the trap door. I followed him. Hungry Jack. On weekends and over the summers, I earned money doing jobs for Johnny McKeon at his From Attic to Cellar consignment store. Johnny felt obligated to me because I was Shan's boyfriend. Usually the jobs required cleaning the store. Secondhand stores are like vacuum cleaners to the world. They suck in everybody's shit. History shows that, like Ealing, when towns are dying, the last things to catch the plague are the secondhand and liquor stores. Johnny McKeon was on top of the world. Sometimes Johnny would receive new consignments out in Grasshopper Jungle, and then leave me to go through and sort boxes, unroll and sweep off rugs, and clean out the drawers in dressers and nightstands. I found a lot of condoms and Bibles in them. Johnny told me I could do whatever I wanted with those things. I threw the Bibles in the dumpster. Robbie and I climbed down the ladder. It deposited us, like visiting aliens, into a common back room that connected Tipsy Cricket Liquors with From Attic to Cellar. The ladder was attached by metal brackets to a plasterboard wall where the electrical panel box for the store was located. I'd seen the ladder there plenty of times. I had even noticed the roof access sign posted on the wall with an arrow pointing up, as though you might not know where a roof could be, direction-wise. I never thought about going up on the roof of the mall before I went there with Robbie. On the other side of the wall was the shop's toilet. It was such a small space that you would be looking straight across at your own face in the mirror, and could reach the soap and paper towel dispensers and wash your hands in the sink while you were sitting on the toilet. Alle Jungfrau could never take a shit in there. There was a sign on the door that said, "No public restroom." Everyone knew the public restroom was at the laundrette, or between the dumpster and the couch in Grasshopper Jungle if you couldn't hold it that far. There was a homeless guy who'd come riding through on his rickety old bicycle about once per week or so. His bicycle was